From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. There has been another attack on Christians in Egypt today. Gunmen stopped buses carrying Egyptian Coptic Christians to mass and opened fire, killing at least 28 and wounding more than two dozen others. This happened about 150 miles south of Cairo. Just last month, two bombings killed more than 40 Egyptian Christians on Palm Sunday. Joining us now is NPR's Jane Araf. She's in Cairo. And Jane, first of all, tell us more about this attack and what happened.
Well, Jeremy, it was two buses full of Christians who were going to visit a local monastery. So it's Friday here, the day of rest, and it's a day when Christians, particularly in Minya province, where they don't have a lot of churches, actually get on buses if they can and go to a nearby church or go to the monastery. They were on their way to a place called a St. Samuel Monastery, an ancient place, 1,400 years old, when they were stopped by gunmen, unknown gunmen, who opened fire on the vehicles. And that's when most of them were killed or wounded. State TV is showing pictures of buses that have been shot up with blood on the sand next to them and shattered windows. So really a horrific scene.
And we don't yet know who exactly did this, but we do know that ISIS has claimed responsibility for other attacks on Coptic Christians in Egypt. How active is ISIS in the country?
Well, the Egyptian government has been waging a very fierce fight against the local affiliate of ISIS in North Sinai province. That's a province that where access is restricted, where it's been under a state of emergency for some time. Now, after the recent bombings in Cairo, just before Easter, the Egyptian government declared that state of emergency would be extended across the entire country. Those attacks were claimed by ISIS. So they actually are very active in parts of Egypt, and they have made clear that Christians will be one of their favorite targets. But the government here has been fighting a very fierce battle in the North Sinai for some time that's unrelated to these attacks.
Now, you were recently in the area where this attack occurred. What are the conditions like there for Christians?
They're a little bit difficult at the moment. So you've got the ISIS attacks on Christians, but even more worryingly to many of them are the attacks by local people on them. And in many towns and villages, these are attacks by people they've lived with for years, sometimes generations. So in Minya province, I went to one town that's been a flashpoint of violence. And in that town, after the suicide bombings of a church and a cathedral around Easter, people had gathered to pray in a house, and they were attacked. Some of the townspeople tried to set some of the buildings on fire. Police now have that town surrounded as they have other towns surrounded, and they're trying to tamp down the violence. But when I asked people in that village what their problem was with their Christian neighbors, they said, "We don't have a problem with Christian neighbors, but we have a problem with churches." So It's not an atmosphere where they feel welcome in a lot of places. The government says it's trying hard to protect them. But as we've seen, there are limits to the protection that the government can offer them.
Jane, what does this say about the state of Egypt in general? It's had so much political turmoil over the last several years, but it's also been trying to reestablish itself as really one of the most important countries in the region. What do you think this says about the state of Egypt?
Well, I think it says, as in many countries, that there are a lot of different pressures at play. And one of the particular pressures here is what's happened after the revolution that toppled Hosni Mubarak, who had this country in an iron grip for 30 years. So after he was toppled, there was a Muslim Brotherhood government that was elected, and then that government was overthrown in a military coup. Now, Christians have supported President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who took power after that coup. At the same time, because they supported the toppling of that Muslim Brotherhood government, that didn't make them very popular with a lot of Egyptians who actually supported the Islamists. So there's that pressure. There is the pressure of the Egyptian president and security apparatus here trying to keep control of a country that is very poor, has a lot of unemployed places. In places, there are young people who are susceptible to the ISIS influence. So it's really a country where they're struggling.
That's NPR's Jane Araf joining us from Cairo. Jane, thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump arrived in Sicily this morning. He's wrapping up his international trip with a two-day G7 summit. The main topics were climate change, security, trade, and immigration. But the real question many are asking is whether President Trump will try to mend fences with some of the United States' most important allies. NPR's White House correspondent Tamara Keith is traveling with the president, and she joins us now. Hi there, Tam.
Hello.
Well, this G7 meeting, of course, comes right on the heels of a NATO summit in Brussels, where relations between President Trump and European leaders really seemed frosty at times. Is the mood any different there in Italy, or Sicily, I should say?
Well, it's a little bit hard to tell because we're kept at a distance, a great, great distance from the meetings that are going on. But, you know, coming into it today, the leaders of the European Union held a press conference and made it clear that, you know, this is going to be, they believe, one of the hardest G7s that they've had in a very long time because there are fundamental disagreements. They didn't say with who, but it's pretty clear that it's with the United States. Fundamental disagreements about both climate and trade.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so then what are the G7 leaders? What would you say would be their most important goal, or what are they trying to accomplish with the summit?
Well, there's one thing that is often overlooked about this. Four of the seven leaders are brand new. And so this is a get-to-know-you session. This is really about building those relationships. I think the primary goal is to come out of it with some kind of unity, at least on the things where they can have unity. Obviously many of the leaders, basically everyone other than President Trump, is going to spend at least part of the summit trying to convince him that the United States should stay in the Paris Climate Accord. President Trump has said that he will make his decision when he returns home from this trip.
Hmm. So let's get back to that NATO summit in Brussels, that frosty summit that we were talking about earlier.
It wasn't even a full summit. It was actually basically just a working dinner and the unveiling of some memorials and the new building.
Okay, great. So, but nevertheless, I mean, the president managed to make a statement in terms of what he didn't actually say, right? I mean, not explicitly affirming the United States' commitment to Article 5. I mean, that idea that an attack on any NATO member nation is an attack on all of NATO. I mean, how are people reading that?
Yeah, and that is fundamental to NATO, all for one and one for all kind of an idea. The White House insists that, you know, he was there at a dedication of a memorial to Article 5. It was called the Article 5 Memorial, and that they feel he didn't have to come right out and say it because he was standing there at this memorial dedication. The sense is that there were a lot of people who wanted to hear him actually say it, to at least in some way talk about the why he values, or if he values, this sort of fundamental tenet of the alliance. Instead, what he did in that speech is mostly tell the leaders that they need to pay more, that they need to pay their fair share. It was something of a lecture. However, you know, the White House thinks the lecture worked because the leaders got together that evening for their working dinner, and they unanimously passed a resolution saying that they would do more burden sharing, or work towards more burden sharing, and that they would that NATO would join the counter-ISIS coalition. And those are two things that President Trump went into that meeting wanting.
Hmm. Has there been a difference in tone between Trump's meetings with Arab leaders at the beginning of this trip and his meetings with European leaders? I mean, that's what a lot of people are commenting on, but what have you seen?
Yeah, it has been different. The Middle Eastern leaders really rolled out a red carpet for President Trump, and he was very much, you know, he when he was in Saudi Arabia, he said, you know, we're looking for partners, we're not looking for perfection. He said he didn't want to lecture them, and he was really reaching out there. In Europe, you know, the relationship is different. He certainly seems to be delivering more of the sort of campaign style rhetoric, whereas in Saudi Arabia, he pretty much softened his tone from what he had been saying before about Islam.
Yeah. So, Tam, overall, I mean, what are your impressions so far of President Trump's debut trip on the international stage?
I would just say that it's been very controlled and very scripted. President Trump has not tweeted much, and most of the tweets have been clearly official. He has not held a press conference, which is highly unusual, and he isn't expected to hold a press conference. This is not normal for a big presidential trip overseas. And he, on a number of occasions, has said something in one of his speeches that, you know, was on script and written in the speech, but then where his aides had to come out and clarify and say, no, he stands by Article 5, or no, he totally believes in human rights. He just didn't mention it in a full-throated way in the speech or in public.
Well, that's NPR's White House correspondent Tamara Keith speaking to us from Sicily. Tamara, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The summer travel season begins this weekend, and national parks will be busy. The first national park, Yellowstone, had a record number of visitors last year, more than 4.25 million, and more than half of those visits took place during the summer. People come to see the geysers. Last year, to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the national park system, we paid a visit to the Yellowstone Geyser Basin and met up with park ranger Rebecca Rowland and Dr. Bob Smith, a University of Utah geologist who's been studying the Yellowstone geysers for close to six decades.
Okay, so we need to start off with the fact that the reason that we've got all these geysers in this area that are erupting all the time is because we're sitting on top of a supervolcano.
Yeah, Yellowstone National Park, what most people don't realize, is actually an active volcano, and it sits on top of a globally significant hotspot, which means it derives its magma from deep in the Earth's core plume area into two shallow magma bodies that are beneath Yellowstone today. And the hot fluids and the heat that is derived from the shallowest magma body at a depth of here, about only 3 or 4 miles, is what drives Yellowstone's geysers.
Rebecca, are they connected to each other? When one geyser goes off, does it have anything to do with the geyser next door?
Well, that depends where you are in the park. Up here on Geyser Hill, where we are now, yes, there's some interconnectivity that goes on. So you've got geysers stealing heat and energy from each other. So it makes it harder to predict when they'll erupt. Old Faithful is all on its own, so there's not a whole lot of other geysers connected to it. It's very predictable. The recharge rate in the large chamber where it gets its water from, its source, is very predictable too because of its isolation.
How do we know when Old Faithful is going to erupt? There's even an app now that tells you when it's going to go.
There is an app. I have it on my phone. We actually enter the times into the app, but it just comes from years and years of observation. And over the years, Old Faithful's intervals have actually lengthened.
By a lot or how much?
By quite a bit. They've gone from 65, 68 minutes to about 94 minutes that we're using now.
And Bob, what does that tell you about what's going to happen in the future with Old Faithful? Or does it tell you anything about what's going to happen in the future?
Well, in terms of future, it's a predictor perhaps of Old Faithful, but not of the other geyser features or the whole volcanic system. As I said, the geysers are just the end product of this whole plumbing system. So the fact that Old Faithful has a longer eruption cycle may have something to do with the total heat flux being less. That system is probably receiving fluids from the surrounding meteoric waters. If those waters go down or up in volume, you're going to change the amount of pressure in the hot water kettle itself.
Of all the things that we know about Old Faithful, you've just discovered something that we never knew about Old Faithful after all these years by putting sensors around Old Faithful.
Yes, in November of 2015, we put 140 seismographs surrounding the Upper Geyser Basin and Old Faithful, and we recorded the data continuously for 2 full weeks. And what we discovered were 2 primary things. Is number one, Old Faithful itself, when it erupts, doesn't really has a very, very weak to no seismic signal. But prior to the eruption, 20 to 30 minutes, we get a large source of bubbling, boiling energy, and we thought the source of that energy would have been right below the geyser. That's what the cartoon says, but it is not. The sources of it tend to be about a few tens of almost 100 meters west at a depth of only a few tens of meters. But I want to make people clear, these chambers that people think about the fluids, it's like a sponge. The rock is really very highly porous, and so the water can get hot, but the surrounding rocks are solid, plastic and hot. But it's not this vision of a tea kettle sitting on a pot. It's just this hot sponge that's heating up.
I want to ask you this question as a park ranger, because I'm sure people do ask you this question. Is it dangerous to touch the water in the geyser?
It depends where. If you are walking by a geyser and water jets out the side of a vent and gets you on your leg, it's going to burn you very badly.
Hmm.
If it goes up in the air, you get tiny little droplets of water with a huge surface area. It cools quickly, so it'll actually come down as cold water.
Dr. Bob Smith, how many places on Earth are there that are like this?
Well, there are volcanic hotspots spread throughout the world, primarily in oceans and mid-oceanic ridges. The most popular ones are Hawaii and Iceland.
Mm.
There's another 20 or 30 hotspots around the world. Yellowstone is the only hotspot of this size that's within a continent. And so as a result of being in a continent, it's very accessible and has allowed us to be able to put arrays of literally hundreds and hundreds of seismographs on the ground to create these three-dimensional images of the structure with depth. 2 million years of active volcanism has created this whole system.
And when you say this whole system, there's a lot of really interesting wildlife in Yellowstone. Does that have to do with the fact that all these geysers are here? Or how does it impact the rest of the ecosystem?
Well, I just wrote a paper called The Yellowstone Geo-Ecosystem.
Uh-huh.
And there we actually correlated the distribution of volcanic rocks and soils with other kinds of vegetation. And we found out that the greatest correlation for animal habitation, for feeding and living, correlates with the volcanic soils and the volcanic rocks rather than other types of background vegetation. And we think it's probably because the chemistry has changed just enough in the soils, it makes it perhaps a little bit more fertile. It's not because it's not high temperature, but there is, in fact, a one-to-one correlation. And therefore, we changed the name of the Yellowstone ecosystem to the Yellowstone geo-ecosystem.
Hmm. Rebecca, as we've been talking about the volcano, what do we know about when that's going to erupt next? I even saw an article that said it was going to go this year, but I don't know how they would know that.
You know, they always say that. You see that every couple of years, maybe it's a 7-year cycle, I don't know. They talk about how the volcano is going to erupt. It's going to be a cataclysmic affair.
I saw that it would wipe out the agriculture in the Midwest. It would cover Los Angeles.
When actually, I mean, a lot of Bob's work and a lot of other scientists' work shows that it really didn't affect sort of the eastern half of the U.S. I mean, it had a huge ash cloud that went out and covered most of the western United States.
This was hundreds of thousands of years ago.
Hundreds of thousands of years. The last eruption of the Yellowstone volcano was 640,000 years ago.
Huh.
And that was a caldera-forming eruption. And what most likely would happen isn't a caldera-forming eruption now. I mean, as Bob says, you go through volcanic cycles. The geysers, the hot springs, those are evidence of the heat underneath us and the end of a volcanic cycle. So what most likely would happen might be something like a hydrothermal explosion rather than an eruption.
What is that?
Hydrothermal explosion is when that steam and that pressure build underneath usually a thermal feature that's already existing. The one we have here is over in Biscuit Basin. It's called Black Diamond and Walpool. They've kind of joined together into one. And several times over the last about 15 years, it's built up, the pressure is built up, and all of a sudden you get huge steam bubbles forming and pushing up on the earth, and it just blows. Mm. It's very violent. The last time that pool erupted, I think Bob was there in 2009, and it was about 75 feet high.
It was 20 feet behind my back.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it had not erupted for 10 years, and I was standing there lecturing how rare earthquakes and volcanoes were, and my colleague was lecturing how rare volcanic or hydrothermal eruptions, and it went off literally 20 feet from me.
Wow.
And blew rocks out of the ground there up to 6 inches of diameter. Now, we've had, since the last eruption, super eruption, we've had 80 small eruptions, like the size of Mount St. Helens, Pinatubo in the Philippines, which are large, which kill people. But we've had 80 or so in the whole Yellowstone region. But we only have 2 inter-event times between the first super eruption, the second super eruption, and the second and the third. And that average interval is 700,000 years. And so people will say, well, from 640,000 years to 700,000 years, we got another 70,000 years to go. But let me stop right there. How many people in your audience have ever bought stock on the stock market on the basis of 2 numbers, that is 2 inter-event times? Nobody would ever believe the mathematics, and I don't either. So this periodicity of the super eruption simply is not real.
So you're not expecting a super eruption anytime soon?
No, but I have earthquake and ash insurance on my home in Jackson Hole.
Like he says, what's much more likely to happen is either a series of earthquakes, maybe a smaller eruption, a hydrothermal explosion. These are the dangers in Yellowstone.
Rebecca, let me come back to why we are here right now. Obviously, this is an amazing park, and we've been hearing about that, and the national parks are amazing. But this is one of the most iconic places in all of the national park system. Why are we so amazed by geysers?
Because they're incredibly rare and unique. And when people first came into the basin, I mean, they were so curious. First thing they did was take a log and toss it into Old Faithful and start throwing chairs in there to see if they'd come back out. Because they had that same curiosity. Yes, they did. In some places in the park, that's not true. I mean, you can't do that. You can destroy hydrothermal features by doing that.
Huh.
But that's what they did because they were curious. And I think our curiosity never dies.
Yellowstone has tremendous amount of background earthquake stresses, volcanic stresses. They're changing all the time. And so the important feature about Yellowstone is it changes all the time. It's a very live system. So I have one closing thought. We've seen pictures of volcanic ash and magma going to the surface, into the atmosphere during the giant eruptions and even the smaller eruptions. So I tell the audience, they should all visit Yellowstone before it visits you.
Which we hope is not anytime soon. Well, Dr. Bob Smith, geologist from the University of Utah, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And Rebecca Rowland, park ranger here at Yellowstone, thank you as well.
Thank you for having me.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Third-party candidates have had some success in Utah, which is a heavily Republican state. Independent Evan McMullen received 21% of Utah's vote in the November presidential election, and now the United Utah Party is making its debut. Jim Bennett is the executive director. Today he announced his candidacy to replace Representative Jason Chaffetz, a Republican who's stepping down this summer. Jim Bennett, welcome.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, first of all, let me just ask you the obvious questions. Democrats have had a tough time in Utah over the past many years. What makes you think that a third party candidate like yourself could do much better?
Well, I think part of the problem is that Democrats have decided it's more important for them to make statements than it is to actually win elections. They've gone further and further to the left, where they've alienated the voters that they need to attract in order to become a competitive party. So we feel that in many ways, our party, the United Utah Party, is the second party in the state of Utah rather than the third party.
I mean, we should know that you come from a longtime Republican family. Your father, Bob Bennett, represented Utah in the Senate for 18 years, and you even ran campaigns for him. I'm just wondering, what's changed since his time?
Well, you look at actually my father's experience. A few months before he passed away, he accepted an award from the University of Utah, and he said in his speech, "I've spent over 50 years in the trenches of Republican politics, yet suddenly I'm the rhino. I'm the Republican in name only." So you've seen the party move to the right while I think people like me have been left behind, and my principles are the same as they've always been.
So on that point, just want to ask you one policy question, because, of course, healthcare, one of the biggest issues in America right now. And you know of the CBO's analysis saying that the House Republican healthcare bill could cause 23 million people to lose their health insurance in about 10 years. What is your stance on healthcare reform? Do you see anything positive in what the House Republicans are putting forward now?
Well, the problem with healthcare is that it's such a complex issue that there is no simple solution. I know President Trump at one point said, "Who knew healthcare could be so difficult?" Well, I think most people knew healthcare could be so difficult. My father, when he was in the Senate, had proposed a bill called the Healthy Americans Act that was a bipartisan bill. And I think that would be a good place to start, because I don't think Obamacare is sustainable. But at the same time, the pre-Obamacare status quo is not an acceptable option either. And so I'd be happy to work with both Republicans and with Democrats to try to find what that solution might be.
Mm. Now, you're running in the district that's currently represented by Jason Chaffetz. There's been some significant frustration with voters there. But can you turn that frustration for Chaffetz in particular into votes for you?
I think so, although it's not necessarily frustration with Jason Chaffetz as a person. I think it's frustration with Jason Chaffetz's unwillingness to challenge Donald Trump. And I think that's one of the problems that any Republican that would have been elected from this district would have, because people of Utah want their representative to challenge Trump. And Republicans aren't willing to do that because Trump's their guy. Hmm. And Trump's not my guy. And when I go back to Washington, I'm going to challenge Trump.
Well, Jim Bennett is a third-party candidate for Congress in Utah's 3rd District. He spoke to us via Skype today. Mr. Bennett, thank you so very much.
Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg gave the commencement address at Harvard yesterday, 12 years after he dropped out of the university. He started Facebook in his dorm in 2004 and received an honorary degree from Harvard yesterday. His speech sounded to some like a political stump speech.
Progress now requires coming together, not just as cities or nations, but also as a global community. But we live in an unstable time. There are people left behind by globalization across the whole world. And it's tough to care about people in other places when we don't first feel good about our lives here at home. There's pressure to turn inwards. This is the struggle of our time. The forces of freedom, openness, and global community against the forces of authoritarianism, isolationism, and nationalism. Forces for the flow of knowledge, trade, and immigration against those who would slow them down. This is not a battle of nations. It is a battle of ideas.
Zuckerberg also talked about his career, his failures, and successes.
It's really good to be idealistic, but be prepared to be misunderstood. Anyone working on a big vision is going to get called crazy, even if you end up right. Anyone taking on a complex problem is going to get blamed for not fully understanding it, even though it's impossible to know everything up front. Anyone taking initiative will always get criticized for moving too fast, because there's always someone who wants to slow you down. In our society, we often don't take on big things because we're so afraid of making mistakes that we ignore all the things wrong today if we do nothing. The reality is, anything we do today is going to have some issues in the future. But that can't stop us from getting started.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg speaking yesterday at Harvard's commencement.
Hala Alyan was 4 years old when Iraqi forces invaded Kuwait. Her family packed up what they could and fled. In the years that followed, they moved over a dozen times between the Middle East and the U.S. And as she grew up and tried to process the chaos and constant moving, Alyan began to write. She's now an award-winning poet and a clinical psychologist, and she's published her first novel, Salt Houses. It follows a Palestinian family grappling with displacement. I spoke with Alyan recently when I was a lot healthier than I am now, and she told me about her own journey away from home.
I was 4, so some of my earliest memories are from that time, but most of it obviously has been filtered through my parents. I think the most salient memory is I had just turned 4, and my mother had wanted me not to open all my birthday presents at once. So we left a bunch of unopened birthday gifts. And that was something that my mother would cry about year after year, remembering that time. It was a time when banks shut down. My mom escaped with me, and she was pregnant with my brother and drove through Iraq, went to Syria. When my father was able to catch up with us, he went to Syria as well.
Oh, it's interesting.
We were there for a little bit. And then,
Syria doesn't seem like a place of refuge today.
Which is what's so fascinating to think about. I mean, in that region and in general, the idea of immigration and displacement, it's places that were refuge, are not anymore, that many places that are shelters have become places where people flee.
So in all the times and places that you had to move in the intervening years, I mean, what effect did that have on you and your family, family and how it sort of defined itself and saw itself?
Yeah, I think it sort of manifested differently in all of us. I mean, I think for myself and my brother and my sister, it sort of manifested in wanting to tell stories and becoming writers and artists and becoming very kind of obsessed with this idea of memory and nostalgia and how to recreate memory and preserve it. It's been interesting to see how it manifests differently between my mother and father. My father's very restless and has a hard time settling in any one city. Whereas my mother loves to think about homes and just nesting and loves Architectural Digest. And so I think it's kind of manifested very differently in our family. But there is a shared understanding that, you know, you can't take any city for granted.
Yeah.
You don't know what will happen.
Yeah. Well, in your novel, Salt Houses, you follow a Palestinian family over time. But one of the key people at the center of the book is Salma. Right?
Yes.
Yeah, she's the matriarch, of this family. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about her and why you wanted to put her at the center of the novel.
Well, so the character that ends up kind of popping up is her daughter, Alia.
Yeah.
But the very heart of it would be Salma, would be this original character who was raising her children in that kind of interesting, very politically tense period of time between 1948 and 1967 in what is now the West Bank. And she's sort of trying to manage her desires for her children with political realities, trying to keep them safe, but also connected to their homeland. And it really all begins with her. Mm-hmm. And then when the Six-Day War happens, they lose their house and they find themselves in Kuwait, only to be displaced again after a couple of decades.
Yeah. So it's so interesting about hearing this particular story, this kind of story about a Palestinian family, because it's not one that we often get a chance to hear about or explore. I mean, was that part of the impetus for you for writing the novel?
I wouldn't say that I set out with a particular agenda. I know that as I was writing, I was falling in love with the family and I was becoming very invested and I wanted to do justice to this particular family. And I think in trying to do that, it became kind of a more, a bigger glimpse into the situation in general and into the idea of displacement and diasporic experience and memory in general. I think the book definitely doesn't purport to be representative of the entire Palestinian experience. This is a very specific family with socioeconomic background, with certain privileges, with certain opportunities. And I do think it's, you know, from what I've heard from people, I think that can sometimes make it a little bit easier to connect to for many readers who have a certain amount of luxury and privilege to be able to see themselves in these characters that were able to have the financial privilege of leaving, you know, and being able to get passports and being able to move to different cities.
Right, right. So you mentioned a little bit earlier how Alia, Salma's daughter, is different from her mother. I mean, tell us a little bit about how you explore those differences.
Well, I think, you know, it's sort of the classical, like, intergenerational conflict, right? So, like, I think that's one of the things that the book kind of looks at is how it's really hard to raise children in a country that is not your own, where there's a value system, where there's a belief system, where there's a way of doing things that's very different to how you grew up. So I do think there's a lot of rebelling within some of the parental child relationships in the book. I've always been interested in that idea of intergenerational trauma and how it manifests differently from generation to generation. But also, I think a lot of the times that's one of the ways in which these familial relationships end up getting really complicated.
Yeah.
You know, you grow up, I mean, someone who's born and raised in Boston, for example, is going to have a very different connection and idea of family and home than someone who immigrated here when they're 45.
Mm. You know, your book comes along at a time where, of course, our national conversation about refugees who make up a significant part of any group's diaspora around the world. It's you know, it's very complicated and it's very fraught.
Yeah,
obviously, not just here in the United States, but in many places. I'm just wondering, you know, how how you're thinking through that mm-hmm. in terms of your own personal experience as well.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, there's my experience. There's the experience that I've seen with a lot of the patients that I work with in clinical work. Yeah. I like to think of it as a lack of imagination on some level, that I think for a lot of people, it's very difficult to really understand what it must be like when you have to flee a country. And there's that whole quote of like, it's, you know, you only put your kid on a raft and put them out to sea if it's safer than the land, that people are not doing this because they're trying to sneak their way into countries. People are not fleeing by the millions just to try to like inundate these Western countries. They're doing it because they have no other choice. Most people don't want to leave their home country. Mm-hmm. They'd rather stay. And I do think that there's a certain, I mean, hopefully, being able to force ourselves to be a little bit uncomfortable and have conversations that are difficult, it might help us challenge some of these ideas that we have.
Yeah. Well, Hala Alyan, she is a Palestinian-American writer and a clinical psychologist, as you mentioned. Her debut novel is Salt Houses. Thank you so much for coming in, and thank you for the book.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
New York City's bike share program, City Bike, turns 4 years old tomorrow. It has the biggest fleet of bikes of any bike share program in the country, and last year, riders took 14 million City Bike trips. Joining us now is Jay Walder, president and CEO of Motivate, the company that operates City Bike. He's with us on Skype from Brooklyn. Jay, welcome.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
And how do you measure success in a bike sharing program like this? How is City Bike doing after 4 years?
Well, I think we measure it in a number of different ways. I mean, first off, we're seeing phenomenal usage. And last year we had 14 million trips on City Bike, which is a number that frankly boggles my mind. But I think you can measure it a lot of other ways as well. And one of the ways that we really like is hearing all the ways that people come to us and approach us and say, City Bike has really changed the way that I get around New York, and it's really changed my life.
Do you have a sense of who is riding these bike share bikes?
We do. It tends to be people 20 to 55, so you know we're not reaching up to a lot of older people, and they're not. It's not homogeneous. It's lots and lots of different people using it for lots of different reasons.
Are tourists using them?
Absolutely, although in particular areas. So there's probably three big tourist things in New York. One is to go around Central Park, not surprising. The second is along the rivers, which have been opened up in the last decade, and I think really presenting a whole new fascinating way of seeing New York. And the third is to go over the Brooklyn Bridge. And I have to say that I'm a lifelong New Yorker, and I started riding over the Brooklyn Bridge, and it just puts a smile on your face. And I think a lot of tourists are finding that as well.
Now, riding bikes on the streets of New York is not for the faint of heart, and it can be dangerous at times. Are you seeing that New York is becoming a safer place to ride a bike, or what are the safety challenges that still exist?
New York City has been engaged in one of the most extensive programs of building bike lanes. And I think that's usually valuable. And the other thing that they've been doing, and I think the city's done this so well, is to be able to integrate city bike stations into the design of bike lanes. And I think safe biking infrastructure is an essential part of the way that we should be thinking about urban mobility now. And it is really a partnership between Motivate and the city to be able to deliver all of the benefits of biking.
But city bikes don't come with helmets, right? So How much helmet use are you seeing, and is there any way to increase it? Because as we know, all the studies show you're much safer if you're wearing a helmet when you're biking.
Correct. So city bikes do not come with helmets, although we do encourage helmet use. In general, what we try to do is encourage people to have helmets, encourage people to use bike lanes, make sure we have safe bikes, including lights on the front, lights on the back. And all the different ways that we can work to be able to continue to make biking safe in our cities.
So if there's another city that does not yet have a bike sharing program and they're listening to this, what would your advice be to them? What's a lesson that you've learned from putting this together in New York?
I think that one of the biggest lessons has really been about the ubiquitousness of bike share. I mean, one of the things that people say to me is it feels like City Bike is on every corner. I think that's a fundamental aspect in terms of having successful bike share. It takes away the sense of thinking about where a station is, and you just think about place, and you assume that a station will be nearby. Hmm. We are, in fact, expanding a very large program in the San Francisco Bay Area. It'll be 7,000 bicycles, so the second largest program in the United States that will start next month. And we're obviously optimistic and very, very hopeful that the take up in that community will be similar to what we've seen in New York.
Just have bikes everywhere.
Have them everywhere and make it feel like it's part of the urban fabric, part of the public transport system, and to give people the sense of freedom and flexibility and control that comes with bike share. I think people are responding to it because it's offering something that we want.
Now, as we said, New York has the biggest bike share program in the United States, but Paris is still bigger. Why do you think that is?
Paris is the gold standard for bike share in the world. They started this. They've done a great job. We're definitely playing catch up, but we've caught up a lot in a short period of time. You know, New York has seen a 40% growth in bike share in the last year in rides. You're seeing more and more people joining as members, but you're also seeing that every member is using bike share more. And wherever it's convenient, people are grabbing a helmet, they're grabbing a bike, and they're taking a trip. And they tend to be quicker and cheaper and more satisfying than many other ways that we're getting around cities.
Well, bon chance, as they say.
thank you very much.
That's Jay Walder, who is the president and CEO of Motivate, the company that operates CityBike, New York City's bike share program, which turns 4 years old tomorrow. Jay, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.